Hello, here we are again in this timeless retreat. You may see days and nights passing, numbers changing on the calendar, digits changing on the clock, but there's something never changes, the present moment and your awareness of it. The present moment is timeless. So always seem to be sitting here giving a talk, just like yesterday and the day before, just like tomorrow. Yesterday I gave a talk on Anapanasati, according to the Buddhist teachings. Somebody asked me yesterday, can I just quickly repeat those 16 stages with the 3 preparatory stages? So I'll just repeat them very quickly for you. The 3 preparatory stages is finding a quiet place. Number 2, finding a comfortable position. And number 3, establishing mindfulness in the present moment and in silence. That's number 3, establishing mindfulness in the present moment and silence. Is it not turned on? Okay. And having done the preparatory work, then the first stage is breathing in, breathing out, knowing a long breath. Number 2, breathing in, breathing out, knowing a short breath. Those 2 stages are alternatives. You don't have to do one and then the other. Or you can do what's between the 1.5 stage, which is breathing in an average breath, in between stage number 1 and stage number 2. So you're just getting to know the breath. Stage number 3 is knowing the whole breath from beginning to the end of each in-breath, beginning to the end of each out-breath. Stage number 4 is calming that breath. Stage number 5 is developing joy along with the breath. Stage number 6 is developing happiness along with the breath. Stage number 7 is experiencing fully that happiness and joy. Stage number 8 is calming that happiness and joy. Stage number 9 is experiencing the nimitta. Stage number 10 is brightening that nimitta. Brightening the nimitta, making it more brilliant, more beautiful. Stage number 11 is settling that nimitta, making it still, so it's not going all over the place. Stage number 12 is where the mind falls into that nimitta and enters a jhana, called freeing the mind. Stage number 13 occurs after you emerge from the jhana. This is after emerging, which is reflecting on anicca, impermanence. Stage number 14, reflecting on the fading away of things, viraga. Stage number 15, reflecting on the cessation of things, nirodha. Stage number 16, reflecting on the throwing away, the abandoning of things. The stages from 3 till, 11, 12, are done sequentially. The last 4 stages could be done at any time. One after the other, a bit of this, a bit of that, do anicca, or you can do viraga, or you can do nirodha, or you can do throwing away. You have to do number 13, then 14, then 15, then 16. You just do 16 if you like, or just do 14, or do 50, or just do 30. So that's the Anapanasati. Yesterday I said, Anapanasati fulfills the 4 Satipatthanas, So today, I'm going to talk about those four satipatthanas. Four satipatthanas means focuses of mindfulness. In other words, we have mindfulness. Where do we put that mindfulness in order to gain enlightenment? You might have mindfulness on your food, like I've been telling a few people in the interviews. When you come on a retreat, because your mindfulness becomes more sensitive, more bright, the food tastes more delicious. So if ever you want to go out to a 5-star restaurant, if you're going to pay all that money for an expensive meal, you should meditate beforehand. Have a nice deep meditation so your mindfulness is so bright that you can really appreciate all that food you're paying big money for. If you're stressed out and dull, you can't appreciate it anymore. So there are many advantages to meditation. The point is that when your mindfulness is bright and strong, it's so sensitive, you can pick up, say in food, tastes and flavors which are always there but which you are desensitized to because of the speed and stress of your life. But of course, we're not meditating to enjoy our food, although some people might be. What we're doing is meditating to become enlightened. So putting your mindfulness on food may give you extra happiness and pleasure, but it does not lead to enlightenment. Even if you put your mindfulness on the flowers and trees, you might see great beauty in those flowers and trees, but it does not make you enlightened. When we have strong mindfulness, you know, there's a poem by William Blake, which I should have mentioned when I was talking about mindfulness. It's that William Blake was a 17th century English poet who said this famous phrase, "To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour." To see a world in a grain of sand, see a heaven in a wild flower. What you're doing there is actually expanding your mindfulness. So even in a small flower, you see a whole heaven. In a small grain of sand, there's so much going on there. It's a whole world. These are signs of the expansion of mindfulness. When mindfulness expands, it's what I call superpower mindfulness. It's created by doing this meditation on things like anapanasati, letting go, getting close or into jhanas. That's where we get superpower mindfulness. Now, once you have that superpower mindfulness, the idea of satipatthana is telling you where to focus that mindfulness to get the greatest of benefits. And the four places we focus on are the body, feelings, mind, and mind objects. The reason we do that, the reason why the Buddha said four satipatthanas, not three, not five, is because those are the places where attachments lie. The attachments to what we think are as possessions. Remember, when we talk about attachments, there's always a me behind that attachment. Attachments have two ends to them. There's that end out there, what you pick up, what you attach to. And there's this end in here, who or what is doing the attaching. Attaching is like a rope which ties you onto something. But there's always two ends to a rope. The end out there tying you to your object, to your possessions, to your wealth, to your loved ones. That's the end of the rope out there. Now I'm talking about this end of the rope. What's doing the attaching? This end of the rope, what that object, your money, your family, your loved ones, your precious possessions, what they're tied to in here. And that's called the sense of self. It's a fascinating observation by the Buddha. In the suttas he said, whenever there is a self, there will be things belonging to that self. There will be ownership. Whenever there's things belonging to you, there will be a you behind that somewhere. The root of possessions, ownership, control, attachment, is always the sense of self. So we look at these four main objects of attachment to see what's deeply inside of them and see they all come from an illusory sense of self. We think we are our body. We attach to our body. Women do all sorts of things to make their body beautiful. Botox treatments. You do not need Botox if you come to learn meditation, because all of the lines on your face, all the stress lines, get relieved from the calm and peace of a beautiful mind. This saves you a lot of money. This is, as I said yesterday, this is Ajahn Brahm's beauty parlor, where you learn to smile, be happy inside, become much more beautiful. So, but why do people want to do that? When I was in Melbourne about a year ago, it was during the winter time. This December, or no, not December, sorry, about June or, no, was it June or, yeah, about June, July. I was in Melbourne. It was the coldest part of the year. And Melbourne can be very cold. And I saw these ladies going, the latest fashion in the West is wearing this, don't know what they're called, but the shirts only go to just above their navel. And their trousers go below their navel. So they've got this whole band of bare flesh stretching around their middle part of their body. I was so concerned about that. I had so much compassion for these young girls. They must have been freezing. They must have been so cold. Just this band of bare body. Oh, that must have been so chilly. Even with my robes, I was feeling cold. Imagine sort of having half your body exposed to the cold wind and wet of the Melbourne weather. And I thought, what do they do that for, stupid women? What are you doing that for? You're getting so cold and chilly. Oh, because it's fashion. What we do to our body because of attachment to our body. And we always say that, focus on this. Is that body really yours? What is your body? Who is your body? It's interesting, isn't it, that as one monk once pointed out, our body, the way we recognize our body is by looking just at that part above the neck. Sometimes boys fall in love with just the face. The same with girls, they look at the face. They don't look at any other part of the body. That's the main place where we identify ourselves with our face. That's why in your passports you always have a picture of your face. You never have a picture of your elbow. Because why not? You know, if we really look, you can actually distinguish people from their elbows. Every elbow is unique. But you never fall in love with an elbow. You never see a pretty girl and say, wow, you've got such amazingly beautiful elbows, my darling. It's always a case where we look at people's face, and that's how we identify with that person. That's why the elbow never gets old, but the face gets old. We spend all this money sort of trying to make our face look nice. You put makeup on your face, but how many people put makeup on your elbow? So we start to see, what is this body anyway? Why are we so attached to it? And especially when you start to get old, why not enjoy getting old? Why do you have to have all these treatments which hide the facts of life that you're getting old and ugly? Why do men try and have hair transplants or even wigs and toupees to hide the fact they're going bald? Now, I'm very jealous of my elder. I've got one brother, an elder brother. I'm so jealous of him. He's almost gone bald. And he wants his hair. I've still got a full head of hair, and I don't need it. We got the wrong genes. We should have swapped around when we were birth. Why is it people are just so concerned about their looks? One of the nice things about being a monk, you're not so concerned about your looks. When you shave, you all look the same. Even like when you shave your hair and you just wear these brown robes, you can't really tell sometimes who's a monk and who's a nun. You know, the nun who was here the last few nights for the talks, we were deciding, we were talking with Penal Dhammaratta, was she a monk or was she a nun? Because when you wear robes and you shave your hair, there's nothing to tell you a monk or a nun. It's very difficult sometimes. So all this being a woman or being a man, is it really part of our body? Or is it just the way we do our hair and the clothes we wear and the makeup we put on? Is there really a man or a woman underneath? Or is it just the outer appearance? Fascinating, isn't it? If you shave your hair, you're you women, and you're you men, you grew your hair long, and all you men wore skirts and all you wore trousers, will we know the difference? sometimes it's very hard. So it's interesting exactly what is that difference there. Is this body that soul? The body, who does it belong to? Who does your body belong to? Does it belong to you? The focus of mindfulness on the body uses that mindfulness to see what's happening in the body. You find out very quickly your body does not belong to you. It's not under your ownership. If it was, you'd say, body, please don't get sick. This is my meditation retreat. I want to meditate. I don't want to have a stuffed nose. I don't want to feel achy and painy. I want to have energy. There's only 2 days of this retreat left. Only 2 days to get, is it 2 days or 3 days? I've lost count. Only a couple of days to get in my, oh, I want to be healthy. And then you get sick. Have you ever noticed that sickness comes at the most inconvenient times? When you're not ready for it? Do you really own this body? Soon you're getting old. Old age creeps up on us. Usually they say that after, what, 23, 24, 25, you don't make any more neurons in your brain. And the old ones start dying. You've got your maximum neurons about 23, 24, 25. So all of you who are older than 23, 24, 25, you're all over the hill. That's talking about intelligence. Your brain is decaying, even as I speak. You're getting more and more stupid. Your brain is dying. Now, are you ready for that? Do you think your brain belongs to you and you are your intelligence? It's all decaying. When you were young, you could learn things very easily. You could learn languages, you could learn new skills. But when you get old, you can never teach an old dog new tricks, as they say. So, this is what's happening. Each one of you is over the hill. Each one of you is old and getting older day by day. Who owns this body? Nature owns this body, that's all. If nature decides you're going to be sick, then you're sick. Cause and effect, that's all. If there's a virus going around, you can't say, no, it's inconvenient, please come tomorrow. It comes when it's most inconvenient. So, this body, it's not yours, it belongs to nature. And there will come a time when this nature will say, enough, now's your time to die. And all the struggle in the world, all the, it's not convenient, please, can you please come back tomorrow? I've got too many things to do this week to die. Can you please wait until, make an appointment like everybody else? Death does not make appointments. Death just comes when it wants to come. It should really show you this body does not belong to you. So why are people so concerned about their body? Why do we pay so much money going to hairdressers? Why do you spend so much money on designer clothes? Monks don't have designer robes. These robes are not made by Gucci or Versace. These robes are very simple, so they're very cheap. And all the monks wear the same. So it's very, very simple. We don't care so much about our bodies. Nor do we care so much about other people's bodies. Therefore, we're free of the body attachment. We're ready to die at any time. Are you ready to die? Today? Are you prepared? One of these days it's going to happen. When it happens, are you prepared? Are you ready to allow nature to take your body? If you're not, you may argue with nature, but nature always wins. So those reflections should actually tell us what this body truly is. It doesn't belong to us. It's not my body. So if you've got a beautiful body or an ugly body, so what? It's not yours. You don't try and own it. It's like a vehicle, like a car, which has been loaned to you for maybe 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years. Who knows? You only rented this body. You look after it, care for it, and then you have to give it up again. And if you remember rebirth, you've had many, many bodies in the past. This is the latest one. So don't be so concerned about this body. It doesn't really matter how long you keep this body. What's more important is how you keep it. What you're doing, how you're making use of this. how you're using this vehicle to travel on the spiritual path towards enlightenment. That's what this vehicle is lent to you for. So you don't own your body. It's not mine. When we attach to this body, when we tie ourselves to this body, that's when we get very unhappy or afraid when we're about to die. Now, some of you have been testing out to see whether you are attached to this body, and some of you have failed those tests. There are times when just simple things like your hands disappear. In your meditation, you get afraid. Sometimes more of your body disappears, and you go, what's happening? Some of you have had your breath disappearing, and you got terrified. I'm going to die. Listen, I've never had anybody die during one of my retreats. Never, ever. And anyway, even if you did, I'm here, so I can always give you a very cheap funeral. I'll do it myself, no charge. So wouldn't that be wonderful? You save your family a lot of money. So what are you worried for? So, you're not. Don't be attached to your body. But when we meditate, this is why Anapanasati is uncovering those attachments. Because in Anapanasati, you are being forced to abandon your body, to abandon all feelings in your head, your arms, your legs, everything. The body will disappear if you would let it. Why can't we let the body disappear? Because we're attached to it. Because we think it's ours. When somebody takes it away, we feel upset. A couple of nights ago, when it was announced there were bag snatchers in the area, we thought that, oh my goodness, have they gone to our rooms? Why are you so attached to your possessions? You don't own them. There are not bag snatchers here today. There are body snatchers here today, snatching your body. It's called the three thieves of old age, sickness and death, going around in gangs, snatching people's bodies when they least expect it, called death. They are the body snatchers. Are you afraid? Are you ready to allow your body to be snatched from you? So this is how we understand whether we're attached to our body or not. When we focus on this again and again and again, we realize that we do not own our body, it's not ours. We can let it go, not only to get into deep meditation now, but we can also let it go at the time of death. We don't struggle. Unfortunately, I've seen some people who haven't practiced the Dhamma in their life. When it's time for them to die, they just do not allow themselves to die peacefully. They struggle to the very last. They fight for every breath. And it's such a sad thing to see. It's one of the saddest things which I've seen, is to see a person who's struggling against invincible odds at the time of their death, against a force they cannot fight, they cannot win, but they still struggle nevertheless, and they create so much pain to themselves and so much misery to the loved ones around. Why do people do that? It's absolute insanity. When it's a time to die, let go. Be at peace. Your body is worn out. Now, let it go. Your body's only a vehicle. Even if your own car gets snatched away, gets stolen, what happens when your car gets stolen? Usually, if you've got a good insurance policy, the insurance company will replace it, even if it gets crashed before its age is finished. The insurance company will give you a good one in return. If you've really paid up your premiums, you'll get a good car. And if you've really overpaid your premiums, you might even get a better car when your one is finished with. In this simile of your car, your insurance premiums, and when the car gets snatched or crashed or ruined, in that simile, your car stands for your body. If your body gets snatched if it dies after the end of its life or beforehand. If you've got a good insurance policy, you're going to get an even better car next time. Your insurance policy is called karma. Have you paid your premiums? Have you kept up with your payments? Have you got a no excess policy? If you've got a very good insurance policy, if you've been making lots and lots of acts of good karma, then when this body dies, you're going to get a much better vehicle next time. It's called reincarnation. You get a new car. So this is why it's called reincarnation. So what we actually say here, you're reincarnated. So what it's actually saying here is that why are good people afraid of dying and letting go of their body? When you're very, very old, your body is hopeless. It's like an old bomb of a vehicle. Have you seen some of these cars which are so old, they should be taken off the road? Have you seen some of these old people, they're so old, they should be taken off the road as well and giving a new model? Why don't they do that? Because they're attached to their old car. They're attached to this thing, even though it splutters and it creaks and it makes all these noises and things are keeping falling off them as you drive down the street. That's like an old person. Still, we're attached. And that attachment doesn't make any sense at all. So we look at the body first of all. Focus of mindfulness. It's not ours. It's not me. It's not mine. So we're willing to let it go. We're only using it as a temporary home, a vehicle, and we make some insurance payments so we know once this vehicle goes, this body goes, we can get a better one next time. Isn't that good? It means we're not attached. The second focus of mindfulness is your Vedana. I use the Pali word Vedana because too often people call it feelings, and feelings is the word which sometimes refers to your emotions. And that's not what Vedana means in the second foundation or focus of mindfulness. And sometimes people think it only refers to your physical feelings of pleasure and pain. And it's not, it's much more than that. Vedana refers to the quality of pleasure or pain in any of the six senses. Vedana is that part of sensory experience in any of the six senses which is likable or dislikable, unlikable. For example, in the realm of seeing, pleasant Vedana is called beauty. Unpleasant Vedana is called ugliness. You see something you don't want to see, that's Vedana, the unpleasantness. You see something beautiful, that's the pleasant part of sight Vedana. If it's in sound, the sense of sound, you get something like sonorous or sweet sounding, things you like to hear, like praise. That's pleasant Vedana. That aspect of what you're hearing, which you like. Sometimes it may be criticism, or in the chanting in the morning we're off key, or we get that yakka last night, it was shouting at the top of his voice in a party. Now that's unpleasant Vedana. So this is actually what we mean by the unpleasant part. That part of sound which was disagreeable, that's called Vedana. Smell, you know, the sweet smelling fragrance, that's the pleasant part. Really stinky is the unpleasant part. The taste, delicious taste, or you know, bitter taste, is the unpleasant part of Vedana. And physical touch, we're very used to that because we call it pleasure or pain. And with the mind, we have happiness, joy, inspiration, that's all the pleasant Vedanas in the mind. We've got the unpleasant Vedanas in the mind, like depression, frustration, the inner suffering. So with each of the six senses, there's always Vedana, this aspect of sensory experience, which is always there with everything which we experience. Every moment of experience, so any of the six senses, always has some degree of pleasure, pain, or in between. We like, we don't like, or it's in between. That's what Vedana is. Now the point is that it's because of vedana that pleasure or pain, beauty, ugliness, delicious, undelicious, because of that part of life, that's where we gain craving. Every time we have a happy experience, we want it again. Every time we experience pain or rotten noise, we want to run away. That's called the craving. The vedana causes craving. And because the vedana is what we run after in our world, we run after the pleasant sensations, we run away, we cringe against the unpleasant sensations. It's such an important part of our life, the Buddha said, focus mindfulness on that. Understand what it truly is. And if you start focusing mindfulness on this vedana, you come across some interesting, some very fascinating results. You find what pleasure truly is the end of some suffering. The more intense the suffering was, the more wonderful the pleasure is when that suffering finishes. You find that pleasure is just the end of some suffering. That's all. For example, what was the happiest moment of your life? Sometimes people say, the most happiest time of my life is the day I got married. Why is that? Because of all the suffering, the hard work, number one, of finding a partner in this world, going out, falling in love, arranging for the marriage, which is so much stress. When you actually come for the day, there's a release. The suffering of finding a partner is gone. That's why it's happiness. Why is it that when, say, a soccer team wins the World Cup, why are they so happy? Because of all the other teams which didn't win. Happiness is always at the expense of somebody else's suffering. If you win the lottery and become a millionaire, why are you so happy? Because a few million people didn't win, that's why. When you finish university, when you finish school or college, remember that time when you finished your exams and you were free? Didn't you feel happy then? When you did your last exam at college or at school and you were free. Why did you feel happy then? Because of all the suffering of going to school and studying and the stress of exams, that's why. When you've been very sick in hospital, you've had some fever or some disease, and you're finally released, don't you feel the healthiest you ever feel is just after you've recovered from the sickness? At other times you may be healthier, but you take it for granted. You don't notice it. You only notice it when the pain has just disappeared. Happiness is no more than the ending of pain. That's all. So when you understand what this vedana is, you understand even like delicious taste. I was reading about this man who was a gourmet in France. He was very wealthy and he would go to all these 4- and 5-star restaurants every day. I think there's only about 2 or 3 5-star chefs in the world at any one time. These are the best cooks in the whole world. And he would go to their restaurants, or at the very worst, go to a 4-star restaurant. For him, going to a 3-star restaurant was suffering, was such pain. If that was me, a 3-star restaurant would be, oh, it's amazing how delicious that food was. What's the difference? Is the deliciousness or the undeliciousness in the food? Or is it what he's used to? If someone is used to 4-star or 5-star food, and now they have to eat 3-star food, that's called suffering. If someone is used to ordinary food, and now they eat 3-star food, that's called happiness. Can you see how happiness and suffering are all relative? There was a story which I read many years ago from a book called Prisoner Without a Name, Cell Without a Number. It was a story of a journalist in Argentina during the rule of the junta, who, because of his views, had been taken in the middle of the night to a place where he never knew, to be tortured. Many of the people at that time disappeared. It happens all the time in many parts of the world, probably happening even now. He was a prisoner without a name, so without a number, in some underground military complex he didn't know where it was, being tortured with no contact with his family or friends. Because he was a journalist and had some friends in the United States, when he disappeared, they exerted some pressure. They kept him alive. He was eventually released, and he told the tale in a book. Interestingly, though, he said the very worst experience of his whole incarceration was not the times on the torture machines. He said that one day, one of the jailers gave him a letter from his wife. He said that was the most sadistic thing they could ever have done. In fact, he had told his wife, if ever I disappear, like many other people have done, never write to me. Because when he read the letter from his wife and heard about his family, when he remembered his other life outside of those dungeons, when he could compare what he was experiencing with something else, that made the pain of the torture, the isolation, the hurt, that much more worse. After a while in dungeons, you sort of get used to torture. You've got nothing to compare it with, that's your life. But when he heard and remembered the time before, happy with his wife and family, it almost made the torture completely unbearable, almost went insane. To understand how suffering and pain, or suffering and happiness, go together as a pair. That's why, for most people, they have the good guy, bad guy routine, to actually to get information out of somebody. I remember even one of the friends who was in the Second World War is an English in the RAF, and he said it was very stupid once. He said they'd just been returning from a mission over Germany, the plane got hit, and the captain said, everyone jump out, parachuted out. Unfortunately, because he panicked, he parachuted out first of all. He didn't wait, he was so scared. So he parachuted out in the German lines, in the German territory. All his friends waited just for 2 minutes later, and they landed in their own territory. So he got captured, didn't he? He got captured by these German officers, and they wanted the information from him. And so they did this bad guy, good guy routine. He said that one guy, that he hadn't eaten for quite a few days, they were interrogating him. And so one of the German soldiers said, come inside. Now you're a soldier just like me. Just, you know, the wars are just made by, you know, our politicians. You know, we're just friends. So he took him upstairs, and in front on the table was this beautiful English dinner of roast beef and roast potatoes and gravy, freshly cooked, with vegetables, just steaming, and he hadn't eaten a good meal for days. And the German officer said, now look, we're both soldiers, have a good meal, this is for you. And he left him in front of the beautiful plate of food. And as he was just about to tuck in, the bad officer came in and just threw the plate on the floor. No, you can't have any of that. Classic good guy, bad guy routine. Deprivation of food is much worse when you actually see that food. Those of you who are keeping the 8 precepts and are not eating in the afternoon, it's much easier when you don't see that food. But if I brought in a whole tray of noodles at 6 or 7 o'clock in the afternoon, and if you could smell them, if you could see your favorite food, and it was right there in front of you, steaming hot, and you couldn't take it. Now that would be suffering. Now you can understand about comparisons, how suffering and pain are always, suffering and happiness always go together. And all that happiness is the end of suffering. All that suffering is the end of some happiness. That's all. If you're having a very happy time, isn't it the case, already some people have told this to me, They're having a very beautiful meditation. Everything is going well. And then I say, good morning, time for the morning puja. Oh, you hate me for that. That's suffering. Other times, you're sitting down there, you can't wait for me to say, let's do some puja now. Isn't it the case? What's going on there? Your happiness is sometimes the end of pain. Sometimes pain is the end of happiness. Which is why, I think I said already, it is the tradition in meditation retreats to make a photograph of all the retreatants on the very last day. Even those retreats which do Anapana Sati, they always wait for the last day. Because they know on that last day, when you line everyone else up, everyone is smiling so much, they're so happy, because now they can go home. Really, you should actually do the photograph of the retreatants in the middle of the retreat. Not sort of posing, but get a middle of the retreat on one afternoon and just get your photograph and actually photograph reality. Photograph the retreatants as they are actually meditating. I wonder how many people go on retreats then. They're gritting their teeth. Oh, they're hurting. Oh. Now, if you're having a really good retreat, if this, you're really getting somewhere, you're getting peace, you're getting happiness, you're even getting jhana, I would expect of the photograph at the end of this retreat, you'd all look miserable. In fact, I'm going to ask you at the final photograph of this retreat, please look miserable. Please put your worst expression on your face. Please grimace. Look in pain, because that would be a great advertisement for our next retreat. Here are all the retreatants having to go home. See how unhappy they look. That must have been because they were having a happy time during the retreat. Don't you know that Vedana, the happiness and pain, are all relative? Now we find this out in particular when we're doing this part of meditation called Anapanasati. Those of you got some happiness now, why? Where did that happiness come from? Especially when you get into powerful happiness. Why is that the best happiness you've ever felt in your life? Why is it the more you let go, the happier you feel? Because attachments are suffering, that's why. Attachments are suffering, so the more you let go of attachments, the happier you feel. The body is suffering, said the Buddha. And if you let go of your body, that's when you start to feel happy. This is what you're learning when you're doing this meditation. The cause of happiness. What is happiness? What is suffering? This is where you are truly finding out about Vedana. That's why the Buddha was saying Anapanasati fulfills the second foundation of mindfulness called investigating Vedana. Happiness and suffering. This is one of the reasons why I became a monk. Because in meditation I got the highest happiness I'd ever experienced. Why? When I wasn't looking for anything, when I wasn't sort of playing around with girls, music, you know, beer or whatever, why was that the happiest experience? And I found it was because in meditation I'd let go of a whole mass of suffering. That was the insight which comes. The happiness which you experience on this retreat is because of how much you've let go of your body and five senses. If you let go of the whole lot and gain a jhana, that is incredible happiness. It's incredible happiness because you've let go of an incredible amount of suffering. That's Vedana. The third Satipatthana is focusing on the citta, the mind. Finding out what this mind truly is. I've given a simile before about you, the person, being like an emperor in five pieces of clothing. This emperor, this person in charge of you, is clothed with a helmet which covers the whole of his head. down to his shoulders. You can't tell whether he's a man or a woman. You can't tell what race, what age he is, because his head is completely covered. And the top part of his body is covered by a tunic, by a jacket, which goes under his helmet, down to his arms, to the wrists, and over his waist, covering the top part of his body. His hands are covered in the third part of clothing, the gloves, which actually go halfway up his arm. All these clothings are overlapping. You can't see any bare flesh at all. And on the bottom of his body is his long trousers, which go up. His jacket is tucked into those trousers, and the trousers go way down to his ankles. And he's got big boots which go halfway up his legs, the fifth piece of clothing. So with the boots, the trousers, the jacket, the gloves, and the helmet, those five pieces of clothing cover his whole body so completely you can't see anything underneath. You don't know who this emperor is. In this simile, those five pieces of clothing are the five senses: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. The emperor is the mind, the one inside, behind of all this, the one who knows, the one who does, the person in charge of you. And you've got to find out, who is this emperor? Are you a girl? Are you a boy? Your bodies may be a girl or a boy, but what truly is you? Are you Malaysian? Are you Chinese? Are you Australian? What are you? Who are you? What is this emperor? The mind underneath these five senses. The only way you can find out is to take off those five senses. Take off the clothes of the emperor to see the emperor in the raw. And then you find out who the person behind you actually is. This is actually what we do in meditation. We take off seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, and hearing. That's one I left out. When those five external senses disappear, all you're left with is the emperor underneath, the mind. And this is what we need to do to get to know what the mind truly is. The one that knows, the one that does. You. In our meditation, we let go of those senses to the point where, in the ninth state of Anapanasati, experiencing the jitta. That's what the Buddha said. And that jitta appears as this nimitta, this beautiful, still, radiant light in your mind. That's the first time you can understand what mind truly is. That's the time you can understand, you get the insight, should be so clear, that this mind, because it's independent of the five senses, completely separate from the body, that when the body dies and the five senses disappear, you know that that which you're seeing now will not die, but will carry on. It's at that point, when you understand the nature of the mind, that you understand the truths of rebirth. This is an insight which comes at that stage of meditation for many people. You know that rebirth is a fact. You've proved it for yourself. You've seen the mind, that which is independent and underneath the body and the senses. You understand what gets reborn and how it gets reborn. Later on I'll be talking about rebirth. People keep on saying, you cannot prove rebirth. That old story of this person who went up to see this very famous Zen monk and said, "Master, you're a great master, a great Zen monk. You're very wise. Do you believe in reincarnation?" He said, "No." He said, "Why not?" He said, "Because I haven't died yet." Now that's wrong. He has died. Then he's forgotten. Silly master. You have died before. You can't say you haven't. You've just forgotten, that's all. Now you can see why you die and why you live. What gets reborn? So you can find out for yourself, Pachatang Vedita Bo Vinyuhi, to be experienced, each person for themselves. When you do the third Satipatthana, you do the Chittanusati, the mindfulness along with the jitta, that's one of the first insights you get. The insight of rebirth. That is an insight which is powerful because that changes many things in your life. You're not so worried about death anymore when you know you're going to do it all over again. You've got another chance next time. So, not only does that give you an understanding about the nature of rebirth, but it goes even deeper. You start to understand the nature of this citta. The mind, you've already heard me say, is made of two parts, the knower and the doer. You can see that at that stage in the meditation. That's what the mind is. It receives information from the world. It is that which knows what the senses know. It is the knower, consciousness. It also reacts. It does things. It wills. It chooses. It even thinks. When you understand both sides of that, you're getting to know what this mind truly is. And then you've got to find out, that which knows, is that me? Is that a self? You've got to focus and experiment with that citta for a long time to understand there's nothing in there. At first, it's impossible to see. After a while, you get to see that this citta is also just a process. It is like sand on the beach. When you look from a distance, you could think, you assume that beach is a continuous stretch of sand. But when you look more closely, you'll find that that sand is not continuous at all. It is made up of little grains of silica, grains of sand packed tightly together. When you look closely, not only can you see the individual grains of consciousness, just like the sand in the beach, you can see the gaps between them. In fact, on a beach, the grains of sand, if you look closely, aren't even touching. This space between them. In the same way, moments of consciousness aren't even touching. There's gaps between them. There is no continuity of consciousness. Just events of consciousness. Particles of consciousness. Then you understand there is no one who knows. All there is moments of knowing. Now that's a very refined insight. It's usually one of the insights which make you a scheme winner. This is where you get to the heart of things. Already in jhanas, you see that other part of the mind, that which does, the will, you see that disappearing completely. And you understand that you are not in charge. If anyone comes along and says, Ajahn Brahm, that was a wonderful retreat. Someone else comes and says, that was a stupid retreat, the worst retreat I've ever had. It's not my fault. I'm not in charge. Nothing to do with me. There's no one in here. Ajahn Brahm is just the shell. There's no one inside. Understanding that, you don't get upset, nor do you get moved by praise. So, that's doing citta reflections. But you've got to get to the citta first. The last of the Satipatthana is the mind objects. The mind objects is what appears on the screen of your consciousness. Wherever there's consciousness, you have to be consciousness of something. And that thing you're conscious of, any old thing which you're conscious of, is called the mind objects. This is like the light playing on the screen of your television. The shows, the movies, the sport, the news. It is the content of the screen. The TV screen itself and the set is like consciousness. It is that on which all these images are played out. The images are the objects. So in the four Satipatthana, we notice, we reflect upon the images on consciousness. Those images on consciousness, like the simile of the movie theatre in Jamaica, we can get so caught up in those things, thinking this sadness belongs to me. We think I am sad. We think I am happy. We think that I am tired. That's why I've allowed you to sleep, because no one has been sleeping on this retreat. Only your body has been going to sleep, not you. So you don't need to feel sad about going to sleep. No one has been laughing on this retreat. Just your teeth have been laughing, that's all. So you understand these are just objects playing on the movie theater of your mind. And you know that this movie theater of your mind sometimes has a romance. Sometimes it has a horror movie. Sometimes it has an adventure. Sometimes it has a kids movie on it. Sometimes it has cartoons. Has your mind got cartoons on it? So, these are just things which play out on the movie screen that is our mind. When we realize this, it's just a movie, that's all. Then why do we get upset? Why do we cry when somebody dies in a movie? Why do we get inspired, or we also get just so moved, we get all emotional, when finally the girl and the boy make it together and they finally get married? When he gives her the ring and says, "Darling, I love you forever." And she says, "Me too." It's only a movie. It rises and falls. It's just light playing on the screen of your mind. That's all. It's just sound coming into your ears. It's just touch on your body. The objects of the mind are just like that. They don't belong to us. They belong to the play of the world. Love comes, love goes. Pleasure and pain, they come and go. Adventures come, and then they're finished. The journey starts, and then it comes to an end. As your life, as everyone else's life, you may think your life is special, that you've done heroic deeds, but your deeds, no matter how heroic, will all be forgotten in one or two lifetimes. Who will remember you when you're gone? Maybe your children will, for a little while, but then they too will forget. In 100 years, no one would ever know you existed. Even me, I might write a few books, but after a while, they all go out of print, as do you. We're all subject to cessation, disappearance. So what is the big deal? We can let go of all of the events of our life. Those events are called mind objects. Instead of making a drama out of the events of your life, as soon as they've happened, you let them go. You don't keep photo albums of memories inside your mind. You let the events of your life go. Why? For the sake of freedom, for the sake of peace, for the sake of liberation. So that's the fourth of the Satipatthana, focusing on the mind objects, the things which play in your mind. One of the greatest of those mind objects is thoughts themselves. All these words, all these thoughts, so what? Some of you have written some of these thoughts down. Some of these have been recorded on the CD. But eventually, they will all be forgotten. They're impermanent. Don't belong to me. No self. Which is why I do not have, what's it called, copyright on my talks. If any monk copyrights his talks, or copyrights his books, isn't that against the Dhamma? There's supposed to be no owner. So, how can you copyright anything you say? How can you sell it when it doesn't belong to anybody? That's why all the talks are for free. They're priceless. Why? They don't belong to me, so how can I sell it? So those are the four Satipatthanas, the four focuses of mindfulness. Bringing them together again, the body, this feelings, pleasure and pain, the mind, that which knows, and the objects of the mind, the events which play out on the screen of your consciousness. You focus on each one of those because these are the four places we get stuck to samsara. The four places we get attached which make us get reborn again and again and again. The Buddha said, "Haven't you had enough of rebirth? Aren't you tired of wearing nappies again? If you get reborn in the human realm, you'll have to wear nappies all over again. You'll have to get a mother who spanks you again when you're naughty. You'll have to go to school all over again. Do you think you're finished with school? No. You have to go all over again. More homework. More exams. Ooh, do you want that to happen? If you want that to happen, get reborn. If you don't want that to happen, make sure this is your last life. Focus on those four places of attachment, the four focuses of mindfulness. And then you'll find those are the four places where you tie the knots which keep you getting reborn. Untie those four knots, and then you're free. Free from having to go to school ever again. Oh, what joy. So that's a talk on the Satipatthana. Any questions?
Good.
Because now it's 9:05, it's time for the interview time. So those of you who want to have an interview, please come down. Remember, only 10 interviews in the morning, 15 in the afternoon. You know, I'm a very, very compassionate monk, so if somebody comes after the last interview and says, oh, Ajahn Brahm, please, can I have another one? I'd always say yes, you know that. So, so please, try not to do that to me. So come and have some interviews now.